Hey guys, we are back. Thank you so much for being patient with me. I took a little time to myself to see my family. Then I got sick and my voice was just absolute toast, but I am back and ready to go. Hey y'all, what's up? Welcome to Before Amber, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Lady Amy. It's been a little while, so let's jump into it. Jacqueline Duwalaby was born on May 17, 1981, to James and Cynthia Guess. Unfortunately, her parents had a tumultuous relationship, which ended in divorce, and then there was a big custody battle for her. Ultimately, her mother got custody, and shortly thereafter, she remarried a man named David Duwalaby. David ended up adopting Jacqueline, which changed her name to Duwalaby. A few years later, in 1984, her mom and David welcomed a son, David Jr., who they called Davy. While Davy was described by neighbors as mischievous, wild, and undisciplined, Jacqueline was described by neighbors as an angel, bubbly, and independent, yet other neighbors said that she could be quiet and a little shy sometimes. At school, she was described as happy and popular. Most neighbors and outside family described the Duwalabys as close-knit and loving. One next-door neighbor said, "They were always hugging the kids and never yelled at them. They didn't believe in corporal punishment, so the kids acted up. They would take their bikes away or toys, and they never spanked them." Which, you have to remember, this wasn't the norm back then. This was Gen X age of growing up, and parents would spank or at least threaten to. Kids could even get spanked at school sometimes. That's just the way it was back then. Anyways, some neighbors said that they saw the parents do a lot of stuff with the kids, like riding a bike, fishing, or roller skating, but other neighbors said the opposite. They described the parents as lackadaisical parents and didn't supervise their children. Davy would run around the neighborhood doing whatever he wanted and sometimes without even any clothes on. If someone said something to the family, they were just told, "Oh, it's Davy, he's just rambunctious." Clearly, the neighbors had different opinions of the family. Both of them could be true, just depending on what side of the fence you were. On Friday night of September 9th, the family was living in Middle Lothian, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. Jacqueline's parents said that she went to her room that she shared with Davy around 10:30 p.m. Around this same time, Anna, some sources called her Ann, so she probably went by both, was leaving the house to go out for the night. Anna was David's mom, and she actually owned the house, so she was Jacqueline's step-grandmother. She lived in the basement. On this night, she left to go out. She wouldn't be back until the next day. She actually later told police that she left via the back door, something she said that she often did. When Cynthia went to bed about an hour and a half later, she checked on Jacqueline, and everything was fine. She left the door cracked to both the kids' room and her bedroom. The following morning, the alarm went off around 7:30, but neither parent had anything going on, and they didn't really want to get out of bed just yet. Being Saturday, they decided to hit the snooze and sleep for a little while longer. Of course, kids being kids, especially in the 80s, we loved our Saturday morning cartoons. So Davy woke his dad up around 8 a.m. to watch those cartoons with him. It was at this time that David noticed that the front door was ajar, so he closed it. He just figured that his mom didn't fully get it closed the night before when she left. But remember, Anna said that she went through the back door, not the front. When Cynthia got up around 9 a.m., she asked if Jacqueline was up too, and David told her she was not, so she went to wake her. But Cynthia said Jacqueline wasn't in her room. They weren't too worried. Maybe she was up and just somewhere else in the house. They looked around, but they didn't find her. Putting two and two together, with the door being open and Jacqueline not in the house, David suggested that maybe she went outside to play with friends. The couple got in their vehicle, and they went looking the neighborhood. One neighbor said they remembered Davy came up to them and asked if Jacqueline was there, which really stood out because it was normally the opposite. Jacqueline was usually looking for Davy to tell him it was time to come home. After some time of searching the neighborhood, it became clear that she wasn't out there anywhere playing with friends, so they returned home. While they were gone, Anna returned from her night out, so when David and Cynthia got back, they filled her in what was going on, and she helped them search the house again. It was at this time that they allegedly found a window in the basement was broken, so they called police. The call was logged around 10:26 a.m., so about an hour and a half after they noticed she was gone. According to phone records, there were several calls made in that time frame. Maybe it's no big deal. Maybe they were just calling around to see if she was at someone's house. But at least one of those calls appeared to be to like a restaurant. So that was a little odd to me. It could be nothing and totally innocent, but it does show that they weren't fully looking for her in a full hour and a half. When investigators arrived, the search began. There was about 40 volunteer people along with the Midlothian Fire and Police Department that helped with the search. The Coast Guard actually used helicopters and people on ATVs and dogs searched the Meadow Forest Preserve, which was near the family home, but they found nothing. Flyers were distributed with her picture and description. She was 4 foot tall, 60 pounds, with brown hair and blue eyes. While the search was going on outside, investigators were taking a closer look at the inside of the house. They quickly observed that Jacqueline's room was a bit disturbed. There were drawers that were pulled open, clothes and other things were hanging out over them. The bed was actually pulled away from the wall. David and Cynthia told detectives that they had pulled it away when they were looking for Jacqueline. Maybe they thought that she had fallen behind the bed. I know when my son was little, he rolled a lot, and if the wall wasn't there, he probably would have fallen off the bed. The bedspread was missing. The Dwallabies said this was the only thing that was missing other than Jacqueline herself. There also appeared to be bloodstain on her pillow, along with a suitcase that was laying open on the bed. The parents said it was just something that she liked to play with. Maybe she played dress up, and this is like where she kept her play clothes. Just saying, but to detectives, this kind of stood out. It was something they took note of. Maybe someone had tried to put Jacqueline in the suitcase, but she didn't fit. This is just something that detectives think about. After checking the room, they went and looked at the basement. Like everything else in this case, there's conflicting reports. The broken window is a fact. There was a broken window. However, some investigators believe that the window was broken from the inside, not the outside. Others thought that it was broken from the outside, but not recently. The first responding officer, his notes did not say anything about a layer of dust at the window, but later he would say that there was a layer of dust that was undisturbed. The crime scene technician that was documenting the basement reported that there were cobwebs in the window, but they failed to get any pictures of those. I'm not saying the police did anything on purpose, but it does seem like some things may have gotten lost in the investigation. They weren't done as thoroughly as they should have been. This wasn't a normal case for them. They weren't always investigating missing children. So I'm not saying this was their fault at all. It's just important because it was a big point of dispute in the court case. So mistakes were made when it came to the window. Cynthia quickly told police that it had to have been Jacqueline's biological father that took her. This was the first time most neighbors learned that David was not Jacqueline's biological father, which took several of them by surprise. But it was quickly determined that he could not have taken her because he was actually in prison in Florida. I read that Davey told investigators that Jacqueline was, quote, always the one who got spanked so much, end quote. He also allegedly said that his mom hit Jacqueline with a broom, belt, or a rope. But you have to remember, this little boy was only about 4 and a half at this time. How true most of the stuff is very questionable. On Sunday, the FBI got involved to help the local and state agencies with the case. When interviewing neighbors, one next-door neighbor named Holly Deck told police that she was up late watching TV with her 4 dogs. Between about 11 p.m. and 12 a.m., she said the dogs started going crazy, running along the wall, barking in the direction of Dwallaby's home. She said the dogs only barked like that if there was a stranger or someone outside. They didn't do that for someone they knew, and they knew the Dwallaby family and actually liked them. Another neighbor, Bob Tolbert, whose bedroom faced Jacqueline's window, and he was watching TV until around 2:15 a.m., he reported that there was a Tupperware party going on across the street that ended around 1:30. This seemed kind of odd to me. I don't know of anyone that's having a Tupperware party in the middle of the night. Maybe it was earlier and they were just having a good old time and lost track of time. Not saying it's anything unusual. It was just kind of strange. He said he didn't notice anything unusual or out of the ordinary. So again, some conflicting statements from neighbors. At first, the police were looking into the theory of an outside abduction, but as we know, Those are very rare. There were some things that were also troubling the police. They were troubled by the fact that someone could break a window, crawl through it, go upstairs, past the parents' room, into a room with two children sleeping, take one of them without disturbing the other, then go back past the parents' room and out the front door with no one noticing or hearing a thing. That just didn't add up to police. Because of this, they kind of started to look towards the parents a little more. The more they looked into the case and they couldn't find anything that actually pointed to an outsider other than the window, they were like, hey, maybe they broke the window to make it look like it was an intruder. On September 14th, 1988, the search for Jacqueline came to an end. Her body was found highly decomposed in a field behind some apartments in Blue Island, Illinois, which is about 5 miles away from Midlothian, Illinois. She had been strangled to death. There was a rope left around her neck. It was later determined that the rope matched ropes that had been in the Dwallaby's garage. She was partially wrapped in that comforter from her bed. There was a few hairs found on her body in the blanket. One was a pubic hair, which they know was not hers because she hadn't reached puberty. The other hairs actually did not match her or anyone in the family. Again, this was just by comparison. We didn't have DNA back then. After Jacqueline was found, police canvassed the area and questioned the people that lived in this apartment complex. They actually found a possible witness to the case. A man named Everett Mann told police that around 2 a.m. on September 10th, he saw a person. He couldn't tell if they were male or female, but he said they had, quote, a large straight nose, end quote. They were pulling away from the area where Jacqueline's body was found. This large nose to detective described David Dwallaby. Everett Mann gave a little bit of conflicting information when it came to the car. At first, he just described it as a dark vehicle, maybe a dark blue or black, but then later he said it was a mid-sized car, and then a little later he said it was a late 70s Chevy Malibu. Maybe he just started to remember more details, but he also could have been coached to say that because Cynthia actually owned a 1980 Chevy Malibu that was a light blue, not a dark blue. When questioning Everett Mann, they also showed him a selection of photos, so basically like a photo lineup of possible suspects, asked him if any of their noses was the nose that he saw. He picked out a picture of David Dwallaby. The catch, though, was that Mr. Mann was actually about 75 yards away from the car and the person that he said he saw. There were other people in law enforcement that weren't on this case that kind of questioned this. They didn't think that it was possible that he could actually have seen the outline of someone's nose that far away. So they set up a little experiment, and they actually found that it was not possible to see the nose structure that far away. This person talked to the prosecution, but the prosecution was like, we're not going to use that. It doesn't matter. We're going to proceed investigating David and Cynthia. So they took it to a grand jury, based mainly on circumstantial evidence and Mr. Mann's statements. David and Cynthia were both indicted by a grand jury on November 22, 1988, on charges of murder and the death of Jacqueline. Continuing with the theme of the neighborhood, not having the same point of view, some believed that they could have done this, and the other half was like, no way, they would not have hurt their daughter. In April of 1990, the couple went on trial together for Jacqueline's murder, but in a shocking twist, the judge actually acquitted Cynthia on May 1st before final arguments. The judge cited insignificant evidence against her, but David was not so lucky. On May 3rd, 1990, after 14 hours of deliberation, he was found guilty and sentenced to 45 years in prison. In July of 1990, the Chicago Tribune actually published an article about the case based on interviews with the Dwallabies. This started a snowball effect. Because of this article, one of the jurors came forward and said that she regretted the verdict, and she only voted that way because she was being pressured by other jurors. This then led to the release of those results from that experiment that were done by the outside law enforcement, saying that Mr. Mann could not have actually seen David's nose that far away. So on October 30th, 1991, the Illinois Appellate Court unanimously reversed David's conviction, setting him free. Of course, the prosecution appealed this, but their appeals were denied, so David was a free man. So let's talk about some suspects that came up during the investigation. During the trial, the defense actually had a little girl testify. She was 7 years old, and we will call her Amanda. Amanda lived in Blue Island, Illinois, the same town where Jacqueline was found, and this happened around the same time that Jacqueline went missing. Amanda was sleeping in her bed that she shared with her brother, who was sleeping just feet away from her, when she was suddenly taken from her bed. She described it as being stolen. A man took her out of her room, from her home, in the middle of the night, just miles away from the Dualibi's home where Jacqueline went missing. He snuck in and out without anyone noticing. He broke in via a window. He went past the parents' room, took her from her bed, which was next to her brother, and left out the house. Sounds like the same MO to me. But as the prosecution would point out, the man let Amanda go, he didn't kill her, and he actually also knew Amanda. She wasn't a stranger. He lived across the street, and he actually allegedly confessed to her kidnapping. His name was Perry Hernandez. He was never charged with Jacqueline's murder. He has always said he had nothing to do with Jacqueline's case. To me and to many others, it sounds like this was way too many similarities. The next one was actually closer to Jacqueline. Her biological father may have been in prison, but he actually had a brother who suffered from some mental disorders. He was a paranoid schizophrenic. This man was named Timothy Guest. Police questioned him early on, and they ruled him out early on in the investigation because he had an alibi. Or did he? After David's conviction was overturned, Unsolved Mysteries aired a segment on Jacqueline's case. Right away, tips came in. Two waitresses that had actually corroborated Timothy's alibi came forward and said that he wasn't at the restaurant the whole night like they had said. Apparently, they thought the Dualibis were guilty, so they just said, yeah, Timothy was here the whole night. But they actually said that he was only there for a short time, around 9:30, and then he was gone. This would give him plenty of time to take and murder Jacqueline. He also had connections with the apartment complex where Jacqueline was found. Another waitress that worked at this restaurant that Timothy went to a lot lived in those complex, and Timothy had visited her apartment many times before. When Timothy was asked again after these women came forward what his whereabouts were that night, he again said he was at the restaurant the whole night. When he was confronted with what the waitresses said, that he was only there for a short time, he said, quote, "Maybe I was invisible that day. The spirit can help me do that. I was there physically, but no one could notice me," end quote. He also had knowledge of the layout of the Dualibi's home, even though he had never been there before. He also could not explain this other than saying that the spirits told him the layout of the house. Today, Jacqueline's case is still open, but tips are no longer coming in, and investigators aren't focusing on it that much at all. Some believe this is because investigators believe that they had the right person the first time, so there's no reason to continue actively investigating. Because Cynthia and David were acquitted due to double jeopardy, they cannot be tried again. Cynthia and David have since changed their names and moved. When reporters have reached out to them for interviews, they have either refused or just don't respond to those requests. Maybe it's just hard on them and they just want to move past it. Maybe they're hiding something. Personally, I think it's probably just too hard on them. Yes, it was kind of fishy that they didn't hear anything, but Amanda was taken from her home and no one heard anything. The bigger thing for me is that there were hairs found on Jacqueline's body. Based on comparison at the time, they did not match anyone in the Dualibi home. That's a big thing. If those hairs didn't match them, that pretty much points to someone outside of the home. We're in a different time now. Technology's advanced. They should at least try and test them. There's no reason not to. It will either prove that the Dualibis did it and got away with it, or it will point the investigation in a different direction and finally bring justice for Jacqueline. If you know anything about this case, you can contact the Midlothian Police Department at 708-385-2534. That's all for today's case. If you don't already, please follow or subscribe depending on where you listen and leave a 5-star review, as it really does help the podcast grow. If there's a case you would like us to cover, please email us at beforeamberpod@gmail.com. You can also follow the show across all social media at beforeamberpod. I promise I'm going to start making TikTok posts sooner or later. Give me some time. We will be back in 2 weeks to remember someone else. Until next time, thanks for listening. Later. Just a reminder, as always, people of interest and suspects in these cases are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. All sources are listed in our show notes, but some of those sources include newspapers.com, ABC7 Chicago, casetext.com, yahoo.com, and investigationdiscovery.com. Bye.